Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Rebecca, and I will be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships for students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Institute also offers classes, our nation's only campaign management minor, week-long excursions to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 of academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our office or online at hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Arab Uprisings and Revolutions, an Indigenous Perspective. Today's guest is Joseph A. Kashishian. Joseph is the CEO of Kashishian & Associates, LLC, a consulting partnership that provides analysis on the Arabian-Persian Gulf region, specializing in the domestic and regional concerns of Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, as the Yemen. A former honorary consul of the Sultanate of Oman in Los Angeles, California, Dr. Kashishian served as president of the Society for Armenian Studies between 1994 and 1996, and then again between 2004 and 2005, as well as the editor of the Referee Journal between 2007 and 2010. In addition to his weekly column published since 2003, Kashishian is also a senior writer with the Dubai-based Gulf News, which is a top-ranked English language news in the United Arab Emirates. And he is also well-published on national channels. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to see all of you here this morning. The last time I was here was 25 years ago, so I can tell a lot has changed. Hopefully,
come on, Jack.
I'll make one last pit stop before I check out from this earth 25 years from now. Before I start my talk, I want to say a few things which perhaps will help you better understand where I'm coming from as far as the Arab uprisings are concerned. As Rebecca just mentioned, I am a senior writer for Gulf News in Dubai. And during the past year and a half, I must have written several hundred articles and columns on this particular question. And obviously, because I have been working on the Middle East for three decades, most of the time living in the United States, of course, my wife and I decided last year that we would move back. So for the past year or so, we've been living out of her old apartment in Beirut and traveling throughout the region. During the past 12 months, I visited nine Arab countries, spent extensive period of time talking to various people from all walks of life. So my comments essentially today, I plan to do three things this morning. First of all, I plan to give you, when I say an indigenous perspective, I plan to give you the picture of how locals are seeing the Arab uprisings and revolutions, of course. Then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to basically share with you how I see the future of democracy in the Arab world. And I will conclude by making a few comments in the third part of my talk about whether or not a new kind of Arab political equilibrium is on the horizon. So the first part is essentially a summary, if you would like, of how Arabs themselves are looking at what's going on. Not necessarily my views, but essentially how I see them interpreting the uprisings and revolutions. Here it goes. Since 1948, when Israel was established as a Jewish state in Palestine, the surrounding Arab states witnessed continual wars and internal disturbances, all related in one way or another to the central struggle between Israel and the Arab world around Palestine. In 1956, a military campaign against Egypt was an Israeli war to weaken the rising Gamal Abdel Nasser's regime in Egypt. Britain and France served the political and military ambitions of Israel at the time, as well as their own, of course. Then came the 1967 war, which was another opportunity to defeat the rising national Arab movements and to destroy whatever was there in terms of Arab military power facing Israel. What happened in Syria and Iraq in particular after 1967, perhaps other countries as well, but like Libya and Lebanon and Jordan, but essentially we're talking about the two confrontation states, Syria and Iraq, was a direct reaction to the 1967 war. In other words, the rise of Baathism and the power of Baathism in both Iraq and Syria was directly related to the 1967 war. This is at least how the Arabs see it. And of course, most of the Arab world refused to accept the defeat on the battlefield and to challenge the status quo imposed upon it by both Israel and its Western allies. A few years hence, the 1973 conflict occurs, another round of struggle to restore the Arab lands occupied in 1967. The October War, or the Yom Kippur War, as it is known in Western literature, that war led to another misleading course, that is, new military agreements were signed, and one could add futile political efforts to solve the Palestine issue and its consequences by peaceful means. Therefore, it may be correct to surmise that the main objective was to nullify, in 1973, the relative military and political victory that the Egyptians scored, and of course, to freeze the Palestine question. Towards that end, we all know and read about the Camp David Accords that served the purpose that I'm talking about. Once again, it weakened the Arab position around Israel. Since 1973, the Arab world, especially the confrontation states, that is Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, to a certain extent Iraq, entered a phase of internal disturbances and regional wars. The PLO was destroyed in Lebanon. The Lebanese civil war became the main battlefield as Israel waged its war on Lebanon and occupied it for 22 years, from 1982 to 2000, following the civil war, of course. At the same time, Iraq and Iran were engaged in their own war between 1980 and 1988, which ended up significantly weakening both countries. Israel and its Western allies once again played an active role in burning both countries in war. In other words, there were no strong powers around Israel that were allowed to survive. The regional confrontation that emerged, that is, after the defeat of Iran in 1988, Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, committed an unforgiving political mistake, giving the Western countries the opportunity to lay siege to it and to destroy its military power. Of course, here I'm talking about the Iraqi invasion and occupation of Kuwait, and eventually its liberation. The occupation of Kuwait was the beginning of a very long process that ended after two wars. It destroyed Iraq and its military power, and served Iran and its allies to dominate Iraq and to become a main player in Middle Eastern affairs, in Arab affairs, more precisely. Iran, before the U.S. wars, or the U.S.-led U.N. wars, if you would like, towards Kuwait, Iran was a tangential power. Today, Iran is an essential candidate for any kind of solution in the Middle East. I'm giving you this background to make the following point from the indigenous perspective in the Arab countries. Since 1948, the Middle East has witnessed a war on the average every 7 years, a civil war or a major crisis that really exhausted military power of major Arab countries and drained the financial resources of the entire region. The objective, it seems, was to exhaust and fragment the Arab front around Israel and to nullify the main military Arab powers. The weaker the Arab world became, the more Israel received military assistance, political and financial support as well. Therefore, from 1948 to today, the Arab consensus is, and once again I repeat that I'm trying to share with you a point of view that is widespread throughout the Arab world. This is how the masses and the intellectuals and the intelligentsia throughout the Arab world see it, that since 1948, essentially what we had was a continual Arab struggle, internal disturbances throughout the region, either directly, as in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip, or through allies, as in Iraq. Ironically, they will say, the assumed danger of the Saddam Hussein regime, which was really exaggerated, of course. They still haven't found the weapons of mass destruction, but they're looking, was replaced by a more dangerous Iranian regime that is threatening both the Arab world as well as Israel. And I don't need to tell you what you already know, that Iran represents now a real challenge to the international community. Today, Syria, which is involved in its own revolution, even that last stronghold of military power facing Israel is essentially permanently out of the equation. For Syria, and we can talk about this during the question and answer period if you would like, for Syria to get back on its feet will require at least a couple of hundred years. Still, the Syrian regime has committed also egregious political mistakes because it ignored the rights of the majority of Syrians, especially the Sunni majority, which is about 80% of the population, which led to the revolution that we are living on a daily basis. Now, I don't need to make a list of all the Arab political mistakes that have become legendary, but you get the point that the Arab powers, so to speak, Arab military power today is part of fantasy. It's part of fiction. There is no more Arab military power in the confrontation states against Israel. Syria is left to fall apart until it is completely destroyed, and it will be destroyed. Make no mistake about that. And Bashar al-Assad will be removed from power. And another Arab mistake, of course, with the help of Western allies who dominate the scene, Israel will become the only power left in the region. Everything seems, from the Arab perspective, works for the benefit of Israel. The surrounding Arab belt is dismantled, it's weakened, and it's nullified. The long confrontation between Israel and the Arab countries seems to end in the former's advantage. Therefore, the Arab Spring, when it starts in October, late October, early November 2010, the Arab Spring and the new regimes that are rising as a result will inherit a very weak Arab front dominated by two regional powers that aim essentially to control the Arab world, Israel in the west and Iran in the east. The spring will turn into a dark fall, the Arab intelligentsia will argue, if the political powers resulting from the spring indulge in the power struggle that grants political power to a single party, as it happened in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Egypt, and elsewhere. And once again, the Arab intelligentsia argument is that Arab leaders are serving the enemies by committing egregious political mistakes and indulging in the old power struggle that created enemies inside and served enemies outside. This is the first part. Now, turning to the second part of my talk, how do I see the future of Arab democracy and whether or not it is hanging in the balance? Despite what appears to be a genuine democratic movement in the Arab world, the fear of instability persists in various parts of the Middle East. This gives champions of the status quo a chance to advance their argument that favors stability over democracy. Scholars and analysts who have never believed that the Arab world can develop any form of representative government are exploiting today the difficult transitions to democracy in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Yemen, and particularly Syria, to make their voice heard in U.S. academic and political circles. I'm sure you've heard several people throughout the year making this argument that Arabs and democracy, it's like oil and water. Through lobbying, publicity, and media coverage, they have been trying to influence U.S. policy in the Middle East at a time when the Obama administration is preoccupied with re-election, we'll find out in 4 days, and anxious to having to deal with the unexpected or dramatic developments in the region. The fact that a state is despotic does not necessarily make it immoral, wrote Robert Kaplan, a distinguished U.S. writer, who argued in an article written in the Washington Post that it is essential fact of the Middle East that those intent on enforcing democracy abroad forget. Now, a decade ago, such an argument could have never been made in U.S. political circles. Following the shock of 9/11, the real threat for America seemed to be coming from undemocratic regimes and failed states in the Middle East. The rationale was that they are failed, they are rogue states, they are weak states in the world that are perhaps in various ways brutalizing and killing their own peoples, disrupting regional stability, developing weapons of mass destruction, engaging in acts of terrorism, or in one way or another, they are linked with anti-Western terrorist organizations. In such cases, it is the moral duty, therefore, of democratic states to intervene in a variety of ways. Militarily, of course, and even, remember the Bush administration, preemptively, to ensure that humanitarian crises are brought to an end, except in Syria, and that good government is restored or implemented, and that order will reign at the end of the day. Now, in the post-9/11 period, democratic imperialists gained the upper hand, wherein their ideas served as a guiding principle for the U.S. global strategy. In a world where evil is still very real, democratic principles must be backed with power in all its forms, political and economic, cultural and moral, and yes, sometimes militarily. These are not my words. These are the words of former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Iraq was the first step in a long process to implement the strategy, overthrow autocrats and replace them with democratically elected governments. There was this optimism, if you would like, that accompanied the drive for democracy in the Arab world. It didn't last very long, but nevertheless, it was there. The failure to establish full-fledged democracies in Iraq and Afghanistan and the rise to power of Islamist movements in some places, including the occupied territories with Hamas, for example, or in Lebanon with Hezbollah, though the ballot box undercut the influence of the school, giving way to a rival argument to emerge. So-called traditional realists argued that pressure for democracy will present the U.S. with a number of immediate dangers and very few clear advantages. The likelihood of the Arab Middle East to produce fully democratic regimes in the foreseeable future was considered to be remote. Could never happen. It enjoys none of the recognized prerequisites for sustained democracy. The elites were not committed to democracy. The populations were not homogeneous. The national institutions that existed were extremely weak. And the per capita GDP in all of these countries was lower than the level commonly viewed as a democratic tipping point. I'm sure most of you have studied that the tipping point for GDP in democracy is about $6,000. I mean, in Syria, the GDP is 2,000 per capita, so therefore, it cannot possibly become a democracy. That's the theoretical argument. Furthermore, the transition to democracy would almost certainly lead to the disintegration of whatever institutions existed, mostly security apparatuses, muhabarat, military, state security, those kinds of things. So the argument was, well, we don't want to touch the only working institutions. Let's just keep some order in the balance. Because if these institutions disappear, and there is no alternative, then what will you have? You will have chaos. You will have uprisings. You will have violence. I'm sure you follow where I'm getting with this. Worse still for the school was that the likely alternative to the existing Arab regimes, and this is the boogeyman, if you would like, 2 days post-Halloween, that these governments will now be controlled by the Islamists. The Muslim extremists will come and take over. Watch out. The Muslim Brotherhood will come and transform all of these countries into real violent societies. Now, of course, when the Obama administration came to power in January of 2009, developments on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan seemed to be approving the argument of the school. He therefore, our president, essentially dumped, for lack of a better term, the democracy argument. Maybe I'm being harsh. I don't think so. He dumped the democracy promotion thesis and decided to focus instead on stability by strengthening relations with the autocrats of the Arab and Islamic world. The belief that America needed to support dictators or else face a chaotic situation gained momentum in Washington. And the relatively smooth transition in Egypt and Tunisia in 2011 must have really disappointed traditional realists. Now, I'm not saying, please don't misunderstand me, and during the question and answer period, you're more than welcome to question me on this. I'm not saying that Egypt and Tunisia are home scot-free, that they are democracies. I'm not saying that. What I'm arguing is that the boogeyman theory does not apply in Egypt and Tunisia, even though the Muslim Brotherhood is in power. Now, given this post-revolutionary setbacks in various parts of the Arab world, it might be too easy, though, to suggest that the pro-stability school in Washington has completely lost ground. What is clear, it seems to me, is that a fierce intellectual conflict over the direction of Europe's foreign policy and the future of the Arab world is occurring right now among our own country's elites. Alas, this is happening when the Arab world is going through genuine transformation. I've never seen it in the past 40 years. What I've seen this past year, I have never seen before. And it seems to me that if we are to be the global leader that we pretend to be, then we really need to have, we need to extend a hand to those in the Arab world who need the assistance to go from autocracy to democracy. Not just talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And worse, this is happening when the focus in the U.S. is inward, the elections and the economy and all the things that all of us are worried about, rather than looking outward, supporting democratic transition in the Arab world. Now, I have said some in the third part and final part of the paper here that I have presented. I'm going to say a few critical words about what I have seen also in the Arab world. Even though I believe that the democratization transition is genuine and it's going through, and it's my vision, I may be wrong, how I see the Arab world in 2020 and in next decade or so. It is immensely unpredictable, of course, which is also the sheer glory of this kind of analysis, that the post-2010 Arab uprisings and revolutions, not the same things, that will most likely expand to other countries and stretch over the course of at least the next decade. I believe that this will go on for at least a decade, if not longer. Egypt will not settle down until 2020. And what we are now going to witness in Egypt will be the tip of the iceberg with one government falling, another replacing it, the regimes fighting amongst themselves, the institutions going through the whole process of recreating themselves writing new constitutions in several of these countries. This is a messy affair. As we all know, when the U.S. Constitution was written, and sometimes people forget how many years after independence the Constitution was passed, and the struggle at that time. Well, the same thing is happening in the Arab world as well. Yet, I will argue that over the course of a very short period of time, a decade perhaps, maybe a little longer, the confusion that reigned as dictatorships are falling, enhanced prospects for equally epochal changes elsewhere are on the rise. Naturally, internal, regional, and perhaps international responses, which were fine-tuned, ostensibly to protect indigenous interests or intrinsic interests, as in our case. In reality, however, most of these fail to understand when the opposite is closer to the truth. What do I mean by that? The initial panic that followed the uprisings led to utter dejection, as well as envy perhaps, concluding that fresh paradigms, sectarian takeovers to total collapse, ranging the specter, would gradually tame Arab public opinion. There was a thinking that after the initial phase, everything will calm down, Arab public opinion will settle, we will not have to worry about perpetual uprising, continuous revolutions, things will calm down. 2010, 2011, things will calm down. There were few analysts who anticipated the epochal changes that unraveled and continued to upset the regional balance of power. Conspiracy theories revisited the stale hypothesis that pretended the region was subjected to a Henry Kissinger-inspired or plotted division. As I said at the beginning of my talk, this is widespread when you talk to Arab university professors, intellectuals, and so on. This is all a plot to divide. This is an oft-cited hypothesis whose alleged objective is to increase the number of statelets defined along sectarian lines. But this is not a fresh plan. This is not new. If Paris and London schemed to divide the remnants of the Ottoman Empire through the infamous 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement, a 2012 parallel was nothing but the product of vivid imaginations. There is no new Sykes-Picot agreement, no matter what you hear. This is the proverbial, I'm using it, Texas colloquialism, baloney. Still, proponents argued that a new Yalta conference for the Middle East was apparently held in secret between Russia, China, France, Britain, and America. They got together in secret, nobody knows where. And they updated the sinister plot that would further divide and conquer. Equally confused political and religious authorities voiced similar perspectives to help redefine Arab grievances. Some saw, for example, the case of Yemen as a relatively peaceful interim solution, while others vehemently opposed any compromises with dictators who were willing to spread havoc for the sake of power. For those of you who don't know what happened in Yemen, it was essentially an internal coup whereby the president was replaced, was made to resign, and there probably was some kind of foreign assistance to weasel him out, so to speak. But the Yemen situation has not been settled yet, so we don't know what's going to happen there. One advanced the contemporary Turkish secularizing paradigm as a model worthy of emulation in the Arab world. This is actually quite popular now. Sunni politicians in the Arab world saying the model that we have to pursue is the Turkish secular model, and that this is something that we should emulate. Of course, others oppose this point of view as well. In Lebanon, the Maronite patriarch, who has been designated as a cardinal now, he doesn't believe that he became a cardinal, but the patriarch, Bashar Boutros Rai, a cleric who seldom missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity, he asserted, quote, that the Turkish Muslim state, he's talking about the state, of course, separates religion and state completely, respects all religions, practices religious freedom, and follows a democratic system, end quote, which apparently were qualifications for post-uprising entities. Now, this is coming from a Lebanese Maronite slash Catholic religious figure who is promoting the Turkish secular model. Now, my view is that irrespective of conspiracy theories or wishful thinking models, what can we honestly predict for 2020? First, it seems to me that it should be clear by now, almost 2 years into the revolutions and the uprisings, that Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Syria will now go through a long, protracted period of dramatic changes which will take years to unravel. There are very few people who can determine what types of governments will emerge to replace fallen or threatened dictators, although aspects of freedom and democracy cannot be ruled out in all of them. Cynics, or those who prefer that Arabs wallow in ignorance and backwardness, will hark that freedom and democracy are premature in these countries, although this is both unfair and wrong. Second, waves of genuine political changes might also visit North African and the Gulf states, though rulers in Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and Oman, among others, took preventive measures to implement indigenous calls for reforms. To be sure, and please don't misunderstand me once again, I am not making the comparison with European Enlightenment. We're not going to have European Enlightenment parachute down on conservative monarchies or several of the more heavily populated countries that have and are continuing to confront very serious economic challenges. I have in mind two countries in particular that have serious economic problems, Algeria and Iraq. And these countries will have a very hard time getting back on their feet. But neither have these states remained idle. This is something to also confront and accept. On the contrary, I think that the Gulf rulers, the so-called Gulf Cooperation Council rulers, they mobilized whatever existing institutions they had to reignite the engines of change, precisely to avoid potential calamities at home. And one must give them credit that tangible transformations were initiated to meet local needs. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I have in mind here, where Oman, the Sultan of Oman, a country that I know intimately, has fired half of the cabinet, has created a whole bunch of economic reform policies to allow people to have access to finances, to start businesses, and so on and so forth. And he has introduced significant changes in freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and all those other things. Not to be neglected. In Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz Al Saud dispersed $170 billion in 1 month, increasing everybody's salaries, making sure that a variety of reforms were introduced. Again, I hasten to quickly add that I don't anticipate European Enlightenment. Thomas Jefferson is nowhere around to be found here. Okay? You're with me. But nevertheless, despite Thomas Jefferson's absence, reforms are underway, and we should not neglect that. Now, it is critical to note that many Arab leaders are increasingly aware that clinging to power by all means, as in the case of Damascus right now with President Bashar al-Assad, is no longer an effective or a legitimate method to rule. He is the exception. He cannot give power so easily, but he will be brought down. Make no mistake about that. And he will be brought down by his own people. I don't mean to suggest that there will be somebody else bringing him down. Most of the Arab leaders today understand that simple fact, that an effective leader, in the true sense of the word, cannot placate citizens by inventing excuses or just introducing cosmetic reforms. If you were even wary of so-called international allies whose interests coincided on several security features, but whose commitments to Arab welfare was tangible at best. And this is what I have really remarked during the past year, how diminished American opinion is, how little faith most Arabs have of the United States now. And that saddens me to a certain extent. In Syria's case, Russian cynicism and Western sarcasm are coincidental, which is duly noted everywhere you go. Moscow's strategic goals concentrate on their last Arab stronghold. If Moscow loses Syria, they're out of the Middle East. They're gone. There is nowhere else for them to hang anything. Of course, they want to sell some weapons, while Western powers call for the removal of dictators without lifting a finger. Both Washington and Moscow applied unique standards, and both sides have telegraphed that Syrian lives were not worthy, or I should say, not as worthy as Libyan ones, for example. Both sides are shedding crocodile tears about Arab Christians, though discussions with religious extremists continue unabated. All of these foreign schemes skirt fundamental transformations that each and every Arab society is now experiencing. To be sure, their outcomes are not clear, nor easy to understand. Yet, based on frequent visits to several Arab countries during the past year, as well as hundreds of conversations with people from all walks of life, I am optimistic. When a high-ranking Saudi minister acknowledges that Riyadh ought to follow up on King Abdullah's March 2011 reform initiatives, or when a Tunisian writer insists that the Muslim Brotherhood be given an opportunity to display their prowess, both of them illustrate the type of mobilization heretofore unfamiliar in Arab societies. Likewise, when a barber investigates methods to mobilize 100,000 Lebanese citizens to cast blank ballots in the upcoming parliamentary elections, or when an Egyptian dancer insists on her right to earn a living and feed her children. Now the Muslim Brotherhood does not look very favorably on belly dancing. One really can identify dramatic levels of awareness among the population everywhere. Beyond anecdotal evidence, however, and I will close with this, it seems to me the chances are excellent that Arab citizens will insist on better systems of government than what is available today, even if you can predict with any certainty how they will be ruled by 2020. Nevertheless, those who assume that conspiracy theories or secularizing paradigms might cut the mustard are bound to be disappointed, for these are no longer effective customs. It behooves, it seems to me, alert authorities, both Arab and non-Arab, to watch reinvigorated societies where the fear factor is gone. Nobody is afraid in the Arab world today. Let me repeat that one more time so that it really sinks in. Nobody is afraid in the Arab world today. Nobody is afraid of power. Nobody is afraid of authority. This is a dramatic transformation. There is demand for accountability, responsibility, and popular demands. All of this is real. All you got to do is really talk to people, read the newspapers, read the books that are coming out, even if the price to pay is far greater than many of them realize. I'll stop here and I'll take your questions.
If you do have a question, speak directly into the microphone and state your name and a little bit about yourself. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Amber Anderton. I'm a political science major and an Iraqi war veteran. You seem to have a very critical opinion of America's role, and at one point made it sound like we were impeding, and at another point saying we're not doing enough for the movement in the Middle East. And just I'm wondering, at what point will America have satisfied their obligation and stop holding the hand of multiple countries that are seeking to incite their own revolution? And how legitimate would a revolution be if it's managed by an outside source?
That's an excellent question. At the beginning of my talk, remember that I tried to present to you an indigenous perspective, how I see a lot of the Arab intelligentsia looking at the United States. You have no idea how bad I feel as an American, you know, in this mixed, to hear criticisms of my country all the time. But I am open-minded. I want to hear what other people have to say. I don't want to shut the window or the door, if you would like, so that I hear what these guys are thinking. Yet, I'm going to answer your question indirectly by making the following point. We, the United States, and the population of this country, we are about 300-some million. We represent less than 5% of the population of the globe. The Muslim world is upwards of 1.2, 1.3 billion right now. That is not to say that we are enemies, but we have serious problems between the Muslim world and the Western world in general, led by the United States. The Western world, when we talk about the West, we're essentially talking about a leadership question, and we are the leaders of the Western world.
But who's defined that?
The United Nations has defined it in the post-World War II agreements that created the United Nations, where we became the veto powers, essentially. The West has taken over the international system in the post-World War II period. Who defines it? I didn't define it. I was not even born in World War II. It's the reality. You can't deny that. We are a major military power in the world. We have a major economic interest around the world. And the majority of the people of the globe don't agree with the foreign policy that we pursue. And in the Middle East in particular, as I've tried to present to you, there is a serious disconnection between U.S. foreign policy towards Israel and U.S. foreign policy towards the Arab world. If you don't see that, I cannot answer your question.
How many countries do you think we should micromanage revolutions?
No, none. I'm getting there. Having said all of this, it is not incumbent upon us to micromanage anybody's business. But as I've said in my talk earlier, we are the champions of democracy. We are the bearers of the torch. We are the ones that going up the hill.
So we should aid at the...
You asked your question. Would you please, because there are other people, they won't ask questions.
Well, I will conclude by saying that it's not a question of micromanagement. Micromanagement is not what I called for. But I think what I'm arguing is that we, as Americans, must be true to ourselves. If we believe in democracy, it's not just for us, it's for everybody. If you don't accept that, you don't accept it. You're free. That's my argument. Next. Yes.
Thank you very much. My name is Alit. I'm a student at political science here. I'm from Indonesia. My question is about the Palestinian and Israel conflicts. I think that the most successful agreement between these two countries is the 1993 Oslo agreements between Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin. But unfortunately, after the assassination of the former Israel Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, I think there wasn't any progress between these two countries. So my question is, do you think there was any progress during the period of 1993, especially after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin until today, that might be lead to peace in Palestinians and Israel territories? Thank you.
Another excellent question. In the post-Oslo agreement, the Palestinian question is off the table. During the last presidential debates between Mr. Obama and Mr. Romney, the Arab-Israeli issue did not come up. The Palestine question did not come up. Mr. Bush, President Bush, before, during his terms in office, 8 years, he essentially, gave up on the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Arab-Israeli conflict is in abeyance right now. Nobody's talking about it, except diehard nationalists in Damascus and Iraq and elsewhere who are still clinging on, and of course the Palestinians themselves. So the solution, it seems to me, for the Arab-Israeli conflict is neither in Moscow, nor Washington, nor Paris, nor London, nor Beijing. It is between Tel Aviv, on one hand, and the Palestinians on the other. They have to settle this issue. Are they going to do it? Your guess is as good as mine.
Hi, my name is Rachel Erickson. I'm a student here at the University of Utah. My question for you is, compared to the past decades, with the strong social media that we have today, mm-hmm. how much do you think that has fueled the past decade, and how much do you think it will fuel the future decade up until 2020?
My God, I'm impressed. All three questions so far are on the mark. The Hinckley Institute is doing something right, and the political science department at the University of Utah as well. No question about the fact that social media, Facebook in particular, was instrumental in both Tunisia and Egypt. And without it, obviously, we would not have seen the uprisings take on the spin that they have taken. No question about that. You know that in Saudi Arabia, let me give you an example of a country that I know very well. In Saudi Arabia, there are about 17 million Saudis, and there are 5 million Facebook accounts, which is not insignificant. So a lot of these young people are always in contact with each other. They are really challenging authorities. And this is true throughout the region. They're not as well connected, quote-unquote, as the rest of the Western world. And I repeat myself once again, because I always like to make sure that you understand where I'm coming from. I am not making a comparison with Western liberalism, with enlightenment, with all the things that we went through. But nevertheless, this is very significant. And in the future, if you look down another decade or two decades, you're going to see that most of these governments will not be able to handle their populations unless they reform, and they reform fast. As I said at the end of my talk, accountability, responsibility, political participation, the rights of women, which is dramatically changing in several countries. I mean, in the Arab world, you know, this question of women is, of course, a very sensitive question. There is segregation in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, you have a woman totally veiled, and in Beirut, on the beaches of Lebanon, you have them in skimpy bikinis. They're both part of the Arab world. So therefore, you know, you cannot generalize. But nevertheless, this is also changing. There is significant development in education levels, in rights, social rights, human rights. All of this is being fueled by the social media and the access that young people have to Facebook, Twitter, and all these social media networks. It will be dramatic. Yeah.
So I'm Annie Weixler, and I'm a student here at the University of Utah. And I was mostly just wondering if you felt that President Obama has handled foreign policy well in the last 4 years that he's been in office, and if not, could he have done better, and how?
4 days before the election, you put me on the spot here. I think Mr. Obama could have done better. There are lots of us who are disappointed with, because he represented dramatic change, but he played it safe. Mr. Obama wants to be reelected. Obviously, every sitting president wants to be reelected. That's their first objective. So therefore, he tried to play it very safe. And to be fair to him, he inherited an economic mess. We are in the hole, economically speaking. And it's going to be years before we get out of this hole. It might take your generation. By the time you retire, we might not be out of it yet. Nobody knows whether we're going to be able to fix our home, so to speak. But hopefully we will. We're an optimistic nation. But he should have done more in certain areas where he could have done more. And he essentially played it safe. The president is a very cautious man. And in cautious man cannot, I apologize if this sounds too trite. Cautious man cannot dream. And great nations require great dreamers. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you for your presentation. My name is Serhan, a PhD candidate in political science department. Considering the current situation, political context in Syria today, do you think that there is a possibility of redrawing the maps, most specifically when we consider Kurds in Middle East, that this consciousness of Arab Spring would spill over to other communities in Middle East and affect the borders fundamentally?
Absolutely. I think this is right on the mark. One of the consequences of the Syrian revolution in particular will be a total revamp, realignment, if you would like, of the Kurdish question. The biggest winners in Syria, in my opinion, are the Kurds, because they're never going to accept to be treated as undocumented citizens. In fact, Kurds, there are about 3 million Kurds in Syria, and they're not citizens. They were never given citizenship. Last year, in March 2011, President Bashar al-Assad, as he was trying to reform the system, in one of his reforms said that, okay, we're going to give citizenship to the Kurds, and they started the process. After they distributed 6,000 citizenships to Kurds, they stopped. Well, there are 2,900,000 and 94,000 other people who are not citizens yet. You cannot give citizenship to 6,000 people and then close the, close the faucet, so to speak. So it seems to me that the Kurds are not going to accept anything but at least a federal system or confederal system. The danger comes in the following point. If the Kurds in Syria don't settle down, and I'm arguing that they will not, then we have to watch and see whether or not they will make alliances with their brethren in Iraq, in Turkey, and elsewhere, in Iran, to actually create a new independent country called Kurdistan, which has a population of nearly 30 million people. Now, obviously, Turkey is not going to accept this, because if Turkey accepts the creation of a Kurdish state, that means a division, which naturally it will not accept it. Iraqis will not accept it either. Iranians will not accept it either. So therefore, what is the alternative to the division of these countries? Could it be a confederal system where Kurds will have confederal rights within each of the states in which they find themselves? That could be a solution. I don't know. But the Kurdish uprising now is real. And as I'm sure you know better than me, I actually went to Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan this past year. And it's fascinating to see Erbil now. There is a boom, economic boom, the likes of which I had not seen anywhere in the Arab world. It rivals anything in Dubai. Constructions everywhere. There is huge money. The Kurds are building Erbil like there is no tomorrow. And I might say you can fly daily from Beirut to Erbil. So you will not miss the plane.
Hello, I'm Zach, and I'm an international studies student here. I was just wondering, with the crushing sanctions that are on Iran right now, it's not necessarily related to revolutions, but I know that sanctions unequally damage the population compared to the dictators or whatnot that are in power. And so we don't want to see what happened to Iraq in the 70s, you know, like they used to be very. But anyways, I was wondering if there's a viable alternative to these, maybe addressing the rational fears that Iran has, like nuclear-armed Israel, like right outside the Persian Gulf, or maybe like we are withdrawing from two countries like that surround them and whatnot. Is that a possible alternative to imposing these sanctions?
I'm thinking. It's excellent. It's a very good point. I personally don't think that the Salafis will win in the Arab world. The extremist Muslim fundamentalists are not going to win. In fact, yesterday's paper, my column is about Lebanon yesterday, and there is a boogeyman in town in during the past 6 months or so, and 2 weeks ago with the assassination of the head of intelligence in Lebanon, a Sunni Muslim. Everybody was saying this is the work of extremists. They want to bring the Salafi movement and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood in Tunisia, the Muslim Brotherhood eventually in every one of these countries. That's not going to happen. The reason why it's not going to happen is hopefully some of the optimistic things that I have said in my paper. Even if the Muslim Brotherhood is in charge, like in Egypt right now, President Morsi has his back against the wall. He must perform and deliver. If he does not perform and deliver, the young woman who asked me the question has already left because she was bored to death, but the millions of young people who are on Twitter and Facebook and others are going to make additional demands. They're not going to settle for lack of performance. This is what I see changing. This is what I see young generation, people your age, essentially in the streets throughout the Arab world. Let me give you another example. In March or April 2011, I was in Muscat, Oman, and obviously Muscat is a sultanate. It's not Jeffersonian democracy, but people were demonstrating, young people were demonstrating in the streets of Muscat. And in front of Parliament building, Majlis al-Shura, there is a gathering of several hundred young men. And one of them brought home, from home, a box, a mandus. These are the, I'm sure you've seen pictures of them. These are very nicely done, handmade boxes that are used for dowries, usually. So the guy brings the box and puts it in front of the Majlis and asks every young person to write their suggestions and put them in the box. Now, several months later, when I went back, I asked what happened to the box and whether or not anybody had read anything that was written in these boxes. And it's very interesting because apparently the Sultan asked for the box and he read each and every message that was put in that box. Now, this is not something to laugh at. This is real. Where you have an awareness that what young people want in the streets of Muscat or Cairo or Beirut or anywhere else, that you have to pay attention to what these people are saying, that you cannot ignore them anymore. So therefore, there is this accountability at the leadership level. And now that the Muslim Brotherhood has come to power in Cairo and in Tunisia in these two instances, applies to them as well. They have to perform too. They just cannot. They just cannot assume, just because they came to power, that they can sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. That's not going to happen. My prediction to you is that Morsi will not be re-elected 4 years hence, because he will not be able to deliver. And the Egyptian population will be unforgiving of him, because he has a challenge. He has to meet the challenge. If he fails, he will join Mubarak in the extended vacation.
This is Ramazan from the Middle East Center. So when we look at the map, we see that these Arab uprisings took place in sort of regimes that are sort of, you know, that has semblance of, you know, republican arrangements, you know, where we still have very much, you know, strong military-backed regimes, autocratic regimes. And then you also talked about the monarchies, and I know that you wrote a lot about monarchies. And, of course, this is a question that has been asked for a year now. Why do we have uprisings in the republican regimes, but not in monarchies?
This is the subject of my book called Legal and Arab Reforms in Saudi Arabia, which is coming out by Routledge Press in late November, in about another month or so. The answers are in the 350 pages book. You need to read it. It's all right. The monarchies have certain advantages that the republics don't have. First of all, there is paternalism in the monarchies, relative accountability, whereby a citizen, or for lack of a better term, a subject, can actually petition authority. You can go to the prince's palace in his majlis and make a demand. More often than not, those demands are met. So there is a legacy of paternalism whereby grievances are actually met and not put in abeyance. In republics, there are institutions that are corrupt, that are unresponsive to local needs, indigenous needs, and that are ossified, essentially frozen in time. As I have tried to explain this as best as I could, most of the Arab world during the past 50 years was regretfully frozen in the Arab-Israeli conflict, which meant that all of the indigenous problems, socioeconomic in particular, added up and then increased in volume and etc., etc. And at a time when in 2010 the pressure cooker could no longer withstand the pressure, it just blew up. In the monarchies, the pressure cooker is always adjusted. Monarchies are very clever at this. They just always make sure that there is enough ventilation, if you would like, whereby the grievances are handled. Sometimes they deal with it brutally. Sometimes they have political prisoners. They arrest people, like in Bahrain. We have seen what happened in Bahrain. And it's unfortunate, obviously, and several people are killed in the process. Other times, like in Saudi Arabia, we've had very generous financial contributions that have essentially bought time. You know, I mean, $170 billion probably bought the monarchy of Saudi Arabia, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years. And, you know, 15 years from now, something else could happen. You don't know. So therefore, you have a pressure cooker is released, essentially. So there is a safety valve in monarchies. But there is something else as well, which we have to recognize. The monarchies are very limited populations. It's easy to deal with an indigenous population like in Qatar of 100,000 people. But it's much more difficult to deal with 80 million Egyptians. Much more difficult. So therefore, relatively speaking, the monarchies have an easier time than the republics. And to be honest with you, I will add one more thing. The republics were essentially security regimes. They were not real republics. Plato would not appreciate that the name republic, for example, is being used in a place like Syria. Plato is probably spinning in his grave. What kind of a republic is that? That's a dictatorship. The fact that we say the Republic of Syria does not make it a real republic. Can we say the dictatorship of Syria? The United Nations rules does not allow for that, because half of them would qualify.
That is all we have time for today. Please join me in thanking Joseph Kashishian for a wonderful and informative forum.
Thank you. Thank you all.